I think we need encouragement. We need to be encouraged by the Lord. The whole, not the whole Bible, but much of the Bible is related to our encouragement. That the Bible word for that is exhort, to be exhorted, to encourage to do the right thing, to encourage to stop doing the wrong thing, to be encouraged to look to God in trials and to remember Him in blessings. We need to be encouraged. We need to be pressed on. And that's what I'd like to do this morning, is to encourage us. Psalm 105, as we've read this morning, is a history of the Hebrew people. It is a history of giving thanks unto God, to call upon His name, to make His deeds known. If you look there in the first few verses, first five verses, look at all the things that King David tells us that this psalm will help us do: to give thanks, to make God known. It encourages us to pray, to sing songs of praise, to glory in His name, to rejoice, to seek the Lord, to seek His strength, to seek His face. Because God provided for Israel. God made a covenant with Israel, with Abraham, and He kept that covenant. And by thinking about all the things that we read here, how God chose Abraham and promised him a land and a people, and then that, as David penned this, looking back over the history of Israel and all the things that God did to deliver them from Egypt and put them into the land of promise, it was a way of giving thanks. It was an encouragement to David. And it's an encouragement to God's people. In fact, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians, chapter 10, that these things happened that we might learn from them. That these providences of God in the lives of the Hebrew people were given that we might be encouraged and strengthened and learn from their experiences and their example. That God's dealings with Pharaoh and with God and with Israel in Egypt and in the Exodus were given to us that we might look to Him. And if you look over in Psalm 106 in verses 7 and 8, it says, "Our fathers understood not thy wonders in Egypt. They remembered not the multitude of thy mercies, but provoked him at the sea, even at the Red Sea." So they did not think about these things as they were happening. The danger for God's people at that time was that they were looking at the present problem instead of backing up and seeing the wonders of God in their very lives. You might say, that might puzzle you to think about, how is it that God's people could rebel as they look and see all the wonderful miracles that God was doing to get them out of the land of Egypt? Well, I think part of this is verse 7, they understood not the wonders in Egypt. They were not looking at their life the right way. They were looking at what Pharaoh was doing. They were looking at the hardships in the desert. They were looking at the inconveniences. They were looking at how hard their life was at that time, instead of looking how God was dealing with them and working with them in their life. Verse 8, "Nevertheless, He saved them for His name's sake, that He might make known His mighty power to be known." Why did God do this? Well, He did it for His name's sake. And that really might be, you might be able to just say that is the theme of the book of Exodus. God saved them for His name's sake. But the power of God in the book of Exodus was not because Moses was such an awesome guy, and it's not because Israel was such an awesome people. It is because He saved them for His name's sake. That the hero of the book of Exodus is not Moses and Aaron. The hero is God. And all through this book of Exodus, God is wanting us to look to Him, to see His power, to see His sovereignty, to see His might. And that is the story of Exodus. God saved a people for His name's sake. So let's look back to the book of Exodus. So let's turn back to Exodus chapter 1. And with that in mind, let us consider this, that God saved His people for His name's sake. And think about the story of the Exodus, or the beginning of the Exodus, and see how God is working in their lives. And maybe it will cause us to give thanks this morning, to make Him known, to pray, to glory and rejoice in His name, to seek the Lord and seek His strength. When we think about what God did for the Israelites in Egypt, we can rejoice and glorify Him. But remember also that there would be no deliverance from Pharaoh if there had not been bondage. Right? Israel could not be delivered if they had not first been enslaved. There would be no parting of the Red Sea if there was not a wicked Pharaoh pursuing them. And that is why they did not consider the wonders in Egypt. They were looking at Pharaoh pursuing instead of God parting the sea. They were looking at Pharaoh's bondage instead of the deliverer that was sent them. And what I hope that as we think about this in your life this morning, you can consider that your trials, there's a purpose in your trials as well. There's a purpose in your suffering as well. And we need to learn not to look at only the trials, but look above them to the God that has ordained them, and find comfort in that. Well, in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 1, it says, "Now these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt, every man according to his house," and it lists the 12 tribes. Why does the book of Exodus start like this? Well, it starts out with a reminder of Genesis. So you have to come into Exodus thinking about what God did to get them to this point. In Genesis 12, and we're going to look at just two verses real quick here. Genesis 12, verse number 2. So, he starts off talking about the children of Israel. Well, who are these children of Israel? God called Abraham and chose Abraham. In Genesis 12, in verse 2, he says, "And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing." Abraham and Sarah. That's all that there was. It was Abraham and Sarai, actually. He hadn't changed his name yet, but that's it. That's all that there was. They were old, past the age of having children. Well past the age of having children. And God said, "I'm going to make a nation out of your descendants. And you're going to be blessed." So He's going to give them a great people out of two, Abraham and Sarah. In chapter 17 and verse 2, He says, "And I will make a covenant between me and thee, and will multiply thee exceedingly." Verse 4, "As for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations." And He's going to make him fruitful. In verse 7, "I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee in their generations for an everlasting covenant. And I will give unto thee and thy seed a land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." So in the psalm we read this morning, we know what happens, that we had Abraham, had Isaac, the child of promise, and Isaac had two sons, and you had the whole story of Jacob and Esau, and through Jacob's troubles in his life, he has 12 boys, and we know the story of Joseph, where the brothers hated Joseph, and they cast him off and sold him into slavery, and there was a great famine in Canaan. All the while, Joseph was in Egypt. First, he was a slave, then he was in prison, then he got promoted to Pharaoh's house by interpreting the dream. And he orchestrated it to where Egypt had a great store of provisions. And when that famine came, all the people of the earth came to Egypt, or else they would have starved to death. And it so happens that his brothers had to come and to ask Joseph for food. And so he not only asked him for food, but they came and ended up living with them down in Egypt. They were not a good group of people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and his boys, but they had a good God. And God had preserved them through this famine. And God had brought them to a place where they were being sustained. They sojourned there in the land of Egypt. So, we find in verse number 5 of Exodus 1, it says, "And all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls. For Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation." So it started with Abraham and Sarah, and Isaac, then Jacob. Then you had the 12 boys, and the 12 boys and their children. And we have 70 souls that end up down in Jerusalem. That's not very many people when you're talking about a nation. But 70 people came down into Israel. The psalm that we read in verse 24, Psalm 105, 24, it says, "And he increased his people greatly and made them stronger than their enemies." So what happened in the process of time, as time went on, those 70 turned into a lot more than 70. They started growing, and the people started thriving, and the population started to increase. So here they are in a good land, and they started getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. See, it was never God's plan for the people to stay in Egypt. It was never God's plan. And the last chapter of Genesis, verse 24, Genesis 50, 24, it says, "And Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land into the land which he sware unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." The plan was not for them to stay in Egypt. The plan had always been for them to be in Canaan. And Joseph knew that. Joseph, when he died, he said, "Don't leave my bones down here in Egypt, because God is going to get us out of here back into the land of Canaan." So there was a time of famine, a time of suffering. And Jacob and his boys had to leave the land that God had promised them and go down into Egypt. They were where God had promised them. Now they had to forsake it and leave it behind and go into another place. Well, now they're there, and it's been a long time, several generations. But this also is part of God's plan. So let's look one more scripture back in Genesis here. Genesis chapter 15 and verse 13. "And he said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve, I will judge afterward, shall they come out with a great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace, and shall be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come out hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. And it shall come to pass..." I will stop there. So God told Abraham, he said, "Look, there's going to be a generation down the road that is going to go into bondage. And for 400 years, they're going to be in bondage. And then I'm going to deliver them, and then I'm going to bless them into the land that I promised you. But this is coming. The promise was not as joyful as the blessing of the promise, if you think about it. God promised Abraham, your people are going to be enslaved, and they're going to live in hard bondage. But there was a reason for that, because God was going to allow them to leave with great substance. But for 400 years, it's not going to be that way. The promise that trouble was coming also accompanied that promise of blessing. So God's promise, His plan was always to bring Israel down into bondage, but always to bring them out for His glory. But God ordained trouble. God ordained trial. God ordained hardship and suffering and toil and tears and weeping. God ordained all of this to bring Him glory. He told Abraham this was going to happen. And it did happen. You had the suffering and the famine that drove them into Egypt. And then you're going to have a lot of suffering in Egypt before God will deliver them out back into the promised land. God's way for us is often difficult. It is often troubling. It is often heartbreaking. But the way God is best glorified is the way that He is ordained. So the reason that I read Psalm 105 is because we rejoice in that. Think of God delivering Egypt. Think of them, the Passover and the Red Sea. But also, I want you to think about this morning. These people lived through that. They lived through the burdens of bondage. They lived through the threats of Pharaoh and the suffering that they did. They endured these hardships. They were living in them. It's easier for us to look back in history as somebody else's life and to be encouraged by what happened, but we also have to remember they lived through it. And the danger is for us is not to apply that. And for us to look back at Moses and say what a great life he lived for the glory of God and not think about Moses and all of his suffering. And then think about our life and say, my suffering has been ordained by God for a purpose as well. So we can be encouraged in this to know that God is in control, just like He's in control with Israel. He's in control in our lives. In that text we read of Abraham, there were three reasons why he said that Israel was going to go into slavery. One reason was that they would leave with great substance. It doesn't say Egypt, but it was Egypt, so they're going to leave Egypt with a great substance. The second reason was because God was going to judge Egypt. It was God's plan to judge Egypt. And the third reason was God's plan was to judge the Amorites in Canaan, but it wasn't time yet. So the timing, God said, would not come until after those four generations, because at that point it would be time to judge the Amorites. So God gives three explicit reasons why Israel was going into bondage, and only one of them was about Israel. Two of those reasons had nothing to do with Israel. One of them was to judge Egypt. One of them was to judge the Amorites. There are other reasons the Bible tells us. The glory of God, as we know. Pictures of Christ, as we see in the book of Exodus. Examples for us in 1 Corinthians 10. God's glory in salvation. God's glory in judgment. That God's name would be known throughout the whole world. There are many reasons the Bible tells us that this happened. But many of those reasons the Bible tells us had nothing to do with Israel. And the reason I bring this up is that your trials and your heartaches and your sufferings in your life have many reasons as well. And many of those reasons might not have anything to do with you. The unnamed Israelite who lived and suffered and died in Egypt that we'll never know his name till we get to heaven, died in Egypt, was a part of God's plan for the glory of His name. That all those things happened that God might be glorified. And that God used that He would judge Egypt, or that He would judge the Amorites, or that He would receive glory, or that Israel would leave with a great substance. You know, as Joseph worked to prepare Egypt for the famine, and Joseph, his plan got Egypt very wealthy because everybody came to buy corn off of them and they paid the tax and everything. You know why that happened? Well, part of that was that Israel would take it with them whenever they left. They took a great spoil with them when they left Egypt. There's all kinds of reasons why this happened. So know that whatever trial that you go through, there is a purpose for it, and there might be purposes beyond your own life. You know, it might be that you might help somebody else down the road with a similar situation. It might be that this trial is preparing you for something else. It might be that you will never know why this particular trial comes, but know that there is a reason for it. They did not suffer in vain. Their trials were not without purpose. Even if the purpose was to judge someone else, there was purpose in all their suffering. So know that God does not have unplanned or senseless suffering. It might be senseless to us, but there is a plan in all things that happen. Nothing is outside of God's predestined, ordained will. So next we see that in the book of Exodus chapter 1, verse number 8, there's a shift here. Everything's going pretty good so far. The people are getting stronger. God already fulfilled one promise that He was going to make a great people. They started out with 70. Now they're growing in number and they're getting stronger. God fulfilled His promise to Abraham. Now what's the other part of that promise that we read? God promised that He was going to give them a great nation. But He also promised Abraham He was going to give him a country, Canaan. Well, they're not there yet, are they? How are they going to get there? They're going to have to leave Egypt. They're going to have to leave the place where God had blessed them. And that's where we get to verse number 8. Now, there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us. So get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set them over the taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for them Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they grew, multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they had made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and brick and all manner of service in the field. And all their service wherein they made them to serve was with rigor. So the Hebrew people were getting stronger. They were getting bigger. And even though they adopted many of the ways of Egypt, they were still separate. They were not Egyptians, but they were Hebrews living in Egypt. And they adopted a lot of the pagan practices and a lot of those things never left them. But they were still a separate people. That doesn't bode well for any nation to have two nations within one nation. We know that doesn't bode well for our nation to have two different nations in one nation. You can't have two different societies in one nation. That's why we want people to assimilate, to become Americans, to speak English. It's not out of prejudice or racism or anything. It's just you can't have a country with two different countries inside it. United we stand, divided we fall kind of thing. And we want people to become Americans, because if you have two different groups of people in there, they're going to divide. Well, we got a political thing going on here because we got two different groups of people. You got Egyptians and you got Hebrews. Another political problem that Pharaoh has, so the first political problem he has is you got two different groups of people in this country. The second one was they lived in Goshen. I've got these written down, but it says in Genesis 47:6, The land of Egypt is before thee, and the best of the land make thy father and thy brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell. So Pharaoh gave Joseph's family the land of Goshen. And it says it was the best land. Chapter 47, verse 11, he gave them the land of Ramses. It was the best in the land. So they had the best, the most fertile land in all of Egypt is where they were living. So as Pharaoh looked out, he saw a mighty people living in the best part of the country, the most fertile land. They also lived in the north, and they lived on what's called the road of the Philistines. And anybody that came from the north went through that road and went through Goshen. And he said, if we got attacked by the Hittites or the Amorites or the Assyrians or somebody, they're going to come from that road to the north, and if they get to Goshen and these children of Israel decide to fight against us, you know, their people already outnumber us. And if you combine them with a foreign army, we'd be destroyed for sure. So he said, we got to get rid of these people. But here's the thing. There's no reason for them to think anything bad was going to happen. Israel was not a warring people. They never, at this point, had an army. They never had any organization. At this point, they're just a big family. Right? That's all that they were. They never had a king. They never had a leader other than the patriarch of the family. They didn't have any organization. They were just a really big family that lived together, and they just kept getting bigger and bigger, and they had good land and good homes, and they were blessed. I think all of this was a pretext to go to war with the people of God. That this was his excuse to start a war, to exterminate the people of God and put them in bondage. Psalm 105:25 says, "He turned their heart to hate his people, to deal subtly with his servants." The psalmist tells us that God gave the new Pharaoh over to his wicked heart. And just as God will turn the heart of another Pharaoh to love Joseph and bless Jacob, God removed the restraining hand from this Pharaoh to have him to turn against his people. That he hated Joseph and Joseph's people in Israel and the children of Israel. Well, it says there came a new king that did not know Joseph, which knew not Joseph. Did that mean that he didn't know about Joseph and just came on the scene and said, "Hey, why are all these people here?" Well, no, that's not the case at all. It's not because he wasn't educated. At this time, this was the place of learning, the place of art, place of knowledge in Egypt. They were very intelligent people, very educated people in arts and sciences and in history. This Pharaoh knew who Joseph was, obviously. He knew who he was. It wasn't because he didn't know who Joseph was. It's because he knew who Joseph was and didn't like him. Acts 7 verse 18 says, "Another king arose which knew not Joseph." And that Greek word "another" doesn't mean just a different one, but a new kind. A new kind of king. Not just a new king, but a new kind of king. He knew who Joseph was, he just didn't like Joseph. He knew what Joseph did and didn't approve of Joseph. He knew Joseph, how Joseph came to power through his God, he just didn't like Joseph's God. And he didn't approve of Joseph's people. There came a king which did not appreciate Joseph, which did not go along with what Joseph said. So it's no in a sense of gratification, no in a sense of approval. He knew him intellectually, he knew who he was, he just didn't like him. And when this new king came to power, he saw all these people who worshiped Jehovah, who had a different God than he did, a different way of life than he did, and he didn't like it. His heart was turned against the people of God because he hated the people of God. So verse number 10, it says, "Let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply and it come to pass when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us." So it wasn't that he just wanted them out of the land. He wanted them in the land, but he wanted them in his service. He wanted their labor, but not their power. He wanted them there working for him and slaving away. He wanted to persecute them, but he didn't want them in his land. Because he could have told them to leave, right? He could have just drove them out. But he didn't want them to leave. He wanted to stay and persecute them. It's almost, if you think about it in terms of the way that Satan does with God's people, that he wants to keep them in bondage to sin and in the ways of sin. And will lead us along and tempt us into sin, and would rather have us in sin and defaming the name of God. One man said the greatest symbol of Satan's enmity against the children of Israel was this, that he hated them and wanted them in Egypt, but also wanted them to suffer. Verse 13 and 14, if you notice there, look at the repetition in those words. "And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and brick and all manner of service in the field. And all their service wherein they made them was to serve was with rigor."